Jean Swanson sees the organizing as partial success.
Did the government do anything towards any of the commitments?
Well, yeah, they did. What we got was in 2007, the province bought about 25 old hotels, and they also made a commitment to fund housing on 14 city sites, which is about 1,400 units of housing. So it didn't add up to much, you know, from 2007 to now, it maybe added up to 250 units a year, nothing like the 800 that we need, but it was better than nothing.
So do you think that there would have been nothing at all if it wasn't for your ability to put pressure during the Olympics?
Well, I don't know. Can't say for sure, but I think the pressure probably helped.
RadioProject.org for the entirety and the front and the end. I thought I did that okay. It's already into the, at least it looks like a minute or so into the labor hour. Speaking of the Summer London Olympics, there's an article by Neil Parthen who, in the latest public eye, it's out on the streets. Some other interesting features, a little blurb on the upcoming grassroots radio conference. And thanks for listening. It's time for me to go. Woody Guthrie starts at 8 tonight, not as 10 o'clock, as indicated in the News Gazette. Check your sources. See you, Folk and Roots will do a better job. Thanks again. WEFT Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio. Incognito Paul today.
Working. Hello, folks, and welcome to the July 14th, 2000 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour. It's also Bastille Day, so happy Bastille Day, when the French people attacked the main prison in Paris and started a revolution. So, you know, keep that in mind. And also, it's Woody Guthrie's 100th birthday. So I think the two are quite interestingly compatible. But anyway, the Illinois World Labor Hour is brought to you over the air by WFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, Illinois, and streamed worldwide at WFT.org. The views and opinions expressed during this hour program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WFT's management, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, you can call area code 217-328-2295. That's 328-2295. And this hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, I'm your host David Johnson here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who has some workers' interest news for us. And later in the show, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's poem for this week from his book, Cries for Justice, is entitled, It's Time for Some Philanthropy. Also here with us today is co-host Pat Simpson and co-host and co-founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour, Bill Gurrell. Now here's time to kick off this week's edition of Workers' Interest News.
Today, 2012 is on track to be one of the driest years ever in Champaign-Urbana's history. Including last Sunday's brief rainfall and Thursday afternoon's mist, the Illinois State Water Survey has only measured a little bit over 14 inches of precipitation so far this year, while the normal measurement through the first 6 months of the year is at least 20 inches or more. In every month of this year, except for January, local precipitation has been way below normal, negatively affecting a lot of jobs. Central Illinois is already in what the National Weather Service has called a severe to extreme drought. According to the service, even if we return to near normal for the rest of the year, we will most likely be well below normal for the balance of the year, and we would have to be significantly above normal for that period to break out of the drought. Over the past 12 months, according to the East Central Illinois Water Supply Planning Committee, our rain total has been about 32 inches short of the average normal, and the committee is urging area residents to be prepared for a more severe and longer drought than we are presently experiencing, suggesting that everyone be taking steps to conserve water as much as possible.
This story I find particularly disturbing, as I'm one of those people who can remember the struggles of the miners in the 60s and 70s to get legislation that would help to protect them from black lung. But recent stories have indicated that, according to the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, NIOSH, the number of cases of black lung disease among U.S. coal miners has more than doubled in recent years. This reverses a decade-long trend that saw a 90% decline in the incidence of black lung, which destroys lung tissue and slowly suffocates miners to death. It's a particularly insidious way to die. Despite a massive decline in the ranks of working miners to only 98,000 today, compared with nearly 500,000 in 1950, the number of black lung cases and the rate of incidence are increasing, including among young miners. Health officials blame the increase on longer working hours, which have increased by more than 32% since 1978, and increased exposure to coal dust. These are largely the results of the drive of profit-mad corporations to extract coal from locations previously considered to have been mined out. the systematic weakening of health and safety standards carried out by both Democratic and Republican administrations has also contributed. Under the Bush administration, former coal executives were put in charge of the Mine Safety and Health Administration, MSHA, and coal companies were told to police themselves. Since 1995, NIOSH has recommended cutting the limit of coal dust exposure in half to 1 milligram per cubic meter, but MSHA has refused to set a stricter limit, and more recently, as reported from the Charleston, West Virginia Gazette, Republican lawmakers added language to a DOL, that would be Department of Labor, budget bill, barring Mine Safety and Health Administration from implementing or enforcing a proposal to reduce exposure to coal dust. So it is a sad state in the United States where victories that have been won in the past are rapidly being lost and at the cost of lives. I would also add that although the stories don't mention it, there has been a decline in unionization, a very serious decline in unionization in the coal industry, and I'm sure it's related to problems because unions can fight speed-ups, long hours, and more importantly, because there's also a suggestion that what laws are even there are not being enforced, what they can do is have on-site representative stewards essentially there to monitor and be vigilant in terms of guaranteeing that there is enforcement.
Yeah, I got something here. This is from the Washington Post. It's by Ezra Klein, and it's from his article called 14 Reasons Why This is the Worst Congress Ever. And what it is a chart, a graph, I guess you might say, the popularity of Congress today. Other approval ratings compared against congressional approval at 9%. That is, folks, only 9% of the people of the United States approve of Congress. The only thing that beats, Dave might be interested in this because of his recent trip, is only 5% of the people approve of Fidel Castro. But that just shows you the effects of, 60 years of propaganda.
Yes.
Okay. Now, tying Congress is Hugo Chavez. U.S. going communist comes in at 11%. And here's a Paris Hilton, but this is from a Gallup poll in 2005 when she's at the height of her infamy. She beats Congress out by 6% with 15% versus 9%. BP during the oil spill, this is a Gallup poll in 2010, they have 16% approval. The oil and gas industry in general has 20% approval compared to 9% for Congress. Banks have 23%. Nixon during Watergate, 24%. Lawyers, 29%. The airline industry, which I think the airline industry should be nationalized because obviously since they're constantly going bankrupt, it's a nonprofit thing, apparently. But anyway, the airline industry gets 29%. And the IRS, I'm really surprised at this. They get 40% popularity.
Interesting.
But I mean, 9% for Congress beat out by Paris Hilton. Where was Hitler here? They threw him in.
Actually, in a moment, I've got a story to comment more about the popularity of banks at this point. So hold on for that.
Well, Bill, that's quite an interesting news story. I mean, that's quite interesting. This is not quite as interesting, but during the past 2 weeks, President Barack Obama's campaign has blasted Republican challenger Mitt Romney as an outsourcer, meaning that he supports closing down U.S. Businesses and moving their operations to China or somewhere else for cheaper labor. Barack Obama's been criticizing Mitt Romney as an outsourcer, focusing on his career with private equity firm Bain Capital. The Romney campaign hit back on Tuesday, claiming Obama's stimulus package failed to protect American workers and help create jobs overseas. If Romney really wanted a juicy example of outsourcing, he'd have to look no further than the president's job council. Obama's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness, 26 business leaders assembled by the president for job-spurring ideas, quote-unquote, includes representatives of several companies that have used outsourcing, fueling job creation abroad and job losses in the U.S., shipping work to low-cost overseas labor markets that has been a trend in American manufacturing for decades. The White House has a plan to curb outsourcing, but companies representing the Jobs Council revealed just how pervasive the practice is. There's General Electric, whose CEO Jeffrey Immelt has served as chair of the advisory board since January 2011. Since Immelt took over GE in 2001, the company has lost 37,000 American jobs and added 25,000 jobs overseas, according to filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Some of these U.S. job losses are inflated by the company's sale of NBC to Comcast in 2009. Chris Townsend, political director of the United Electrical Workers Union, that represents roughly 5,500 GE employees in the U.S., said the company has closed more than 30 U.S. plants since Obama took office. Tom?
More borrowing is generally viewed as a healthy sign for an economy, suggesting that consumers are gaining more confidence and growing more comfortable taking on debt. Americans put more on their credit cards in the month of May than in any single month since November of 2007, 1 month before the recession began. However, overall credit card use is still well below what it was before the Republican-engendered downturn, and economists are saying that May's rise was most likely a temporary response to weaker hiring and poor wage growth, and not exactly a sign of sustained confidence in the economy. Borrowing has increased steadily over the past 2 years, but most of the gains have been driven by auto and student loans, which rose to a record level of some $1.7 trillion in May. Consumers cut back sharply on credit card debt during the recession and immediately after. Only in the past year have consumers put more on their credit cards, and the gains have been mostly modest ones. However, that changed in May when the measure of credit card debt jumped by $8 billion, but it was only a temporary boost. Then, according to the Consumer Conference Board, consumer confidence fell in the month of June for the fourth straight month. One reason is lack of jobs. That group's index is closely watched because consumer spending accounts for 70% of economic activity. The overall economy fell at a lackluster pace during the January to March quarter, and many economists believe that growth slowed even further during the April to June quarter, and unless job growth picks up, consumer spending could weaken and put major drags on economic growth. Pat?
Thank you, Tom. Earlier today, Paul had a story on the LIBOR scandal, and I want to talk about it from a slightly different angle. I'm actually going to be reading from the New York Times. Yes, the New York Times. Here is a story datelined Wednesday, July 11th. As unemployment climbed and tax revenue fell, the city of Baltimore laid off employees and cut services in the midst of the financial crisis. Its leaders now say the city's troubles are aggravated by bankers' manipulation of a key interest rate linked to hundreds of millions of dollars the city had borrowed. Baltimore has been leading a battle in Manhattan federal court against the global banks that determine the interest rate, the London Interbank Offered Rate, or LIBOR, which serves as a benchmark for global borrowing and stands at the center of the latest banking scandal. Now cities, states, and municipal agencies nationwide, including Massachusetts, Nassau County on Long Island, and California's public pension system, are looking at whether they suffered similar losses and are weighing legal action. Dozens of lawsuits filed by municipalities, pension funds, and hedge funds have been consolidated into one major case against more than a dozen banks that are involved in setting LIBOR each day, including, listen to this list, folks, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Deutsche Bank, and Barclays. Last week, Barclays admitted to regulators that it tried to manipulate LIBOR before and during the financial crisis in 2008 and paid $450 million to settle the charges. It said that other banks were doing the same, but none of the others have yet been accused of wrongdoing. This is an important story, I think, particularly for working people, because as more and more there is a tendency to blame public employee unions and their workers for the problems that municipalities and states are having in terms of balancing their budgets, here's a classic example of
who you should really start blaming for these kinds of problems. And I know most of our folks are kind of, it's preaching in the choir here, but at least this is important information to get out the next time somebody says to you, let's blame the public workers for employees for the problems that Illinois and other states are having. The other thing I just want to mention, and this is also a New York Times commentary in the business section, and it's called The Spreading Scourge of Corporate Corruption. Perhaps the most
spreading.
Yeah,
right. I thought it was spread all over. Anyway.
Yeah, well, actually, even in this first paragraph, there's a suggestion of that. Perhaps the most surprising aspect of the LIBOR scandal is how familiar it seems. Sure, for some of the world's leading banks to try to manipulate one of the most important interest rates in contemporary finance is clearly wrong. But it is worse. But is that worse than packaging billions of dollars of dubious mortgages into a bond and having it stamped with a AAA rating to sell it to some dupe down the road while betting against it? Or how about forging documents on an industrial scale to foreclose fraudulently on countless homeowners? The misconduct of the financial industry no longer surprises most Americans. Only about one in five has much trust in banks, according to Gallup polls, about half the level in 2007. And if you go back to the 80s, confidence in banks was about 60%. So we're talking about a pretty precipitous decline here. I think it's important to recognize that even in the hallowed halls of one of the greatest, shall we say, corporate newspapers in the country, they're beginning to be concerned about not only the scandals, but the kind of corrosive effect it's had on confidence in banks. Of course, what I always say is, what are we going to do to try to galvanize that lack of confidence into some kind of counter movement against what the finance industry is doing?
Yeah, well, the thing is that nobody's gone to jail. I mean, these banks, I mean, financial institutions gladly pay, I shouldn't say gladly, but they're more than willing to pay these fines because compared to what they made, it's pocket change. And they're going to keep doing it because they get away with it. Now,
well, Dave, that's the way it is with everything, including job safety, consumer product complaints and everything else. The fines or punishments are never enough to beat the profits that are made.
Yes.
I mean, Ford made that bet with the Pinto in the 70s and got a lot of people killed.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Yeah, and another interesting aspect to all of this, which is being reported now, is that both Tim Geithner and Ben Bernanke, in late 2007, when the crisis was beginning to be apparent, knew that there was manipulation of the LIBOR rate. But, so the story is suggesting these days, at least in terms of the main press, they didn't want to reveal this because things were already shaky enough.
Oh, well, yeah. But what's interesting, too, is looking at the most recent presidential campaign contribution figures is that as of date, Mitt Romney's received It's like $9 million from the banking financial industry, and Barack Obama's received $14 million from the banking and financial industry. So, you know, I'm not real confident about anything changing here in the near future with this, unfortunately. And the only way it's going to change is if people start, you know, making an uproar of this, you know, because it's business as usual. You know, both political parties are selling us out. Nothing new there. But I mean, this stuff's going to keep. It's going to continue until people start going to jail.
Well, Dave, here's something, too. Pat and I were talking earlier, and on the previous show, News from Neptune, there was a segment that mentioned something about how the American labor movement has basically spent $4.4 billion over so many years on political campaigns supporting the Democratic Party. Well, this is something I think that they ought to just stop that and do issue campaigns and hit things like this hard. Maybe take some of that money, start their own satellite network.
Yes.
Audio and radio, you know, and a lot of things like that. I mean, you can do a lot with $4.4 billion, you know, besides helping get people elected that don't really do much for you.
Yes.
Well, as the recent elections in AFSCME indicated, there is a big debate going on in the labor movement and many unions right now about their relation to electoral politics, thank goodness. And in the future, we've talked about actually doing a program on kind of where does labor go from here. And I think it would be really worthwhile to cover some of these debates. What's going on is that there is really a shift away from certainly pumping money into electoral politics and figuring out how to spend it in appropriate grassroots campaigns. And again, we can talk more about that in the future.
Yeah, I agree totally, and I think I could make a really good show, and we definitely need to do that sometime before the election in November. Well, I have sort of a related story, Pat. Municipal finance has long been a cesspool. States, towns, hospitals, transit authorities all have been ripe for the picking. Sometimes local officials are paid off, anything from cold hard cash to gifts to skybox tickets. But much of the time, there's no need to go to such lengths, since preying on their ignorance will do. As we pointed out, even though these bodies often hire consultants, those advisors are often either not up to the task. How can people who don't know finance vet an expert, and or have bad incentives? More complicated deals, which are generally more breakage prone, tend to produce higher consulting fees, etc. Dave Dayan highlighted one example yesterday. The city of Oakland, California has decided rather than pay $15 million in termination fees to get out of an interest rate swap deal gone bad, the council voted to demand Goldman Sachs to negotiate with the city to get out of a 1998 interest rate swap deal without having to pay a $15 million penalty. Currently, because of the locked-in rates, the deal is costing the city $4 million a year. Oakland estimates they have lost $17.5 million in the deal so far. And even though the underlying bonds were sold back 4 years ago, because of that $15 million penalty, the city will have to continue losing money in the deal until 2021. So the City Council of Oakland simply voted to terminate the deal. And if Goldman Sachs won't let Oakland out, the city will stop doing any business with the bank per the resolution. In other words, the headline should read is Oakland to Goldman Sachs drop dead. I sincerely doubt that Goldman would litigate to get Oakland to pay the termination fee, but it will probably instead enlist enforcers, meaning the rating agencies, to issue the usual threats about how Oakland will be downgraded and shunned by investors for daring to press hard to have a transaction renegotiated. Funny how it's okay in our society to break contracts with individuals over their pension funds, but not with financial firms. When ZERP, a tax on savers implemented to prop up the banks that wreck the economy, is making many of these municipal swaps profitable beyond their wildest dreams.
Well, Dave, that sort of relates to the last story where...
Yes, indeed.
And Oakland is standing up, and that's really what's going to be the whole point when everybody just finally says, to heck with it. We don't care. We don't believe in these banks and and all of that, and that we have to toe their lines, mm-hmm. You know, like Iceland did.
Yes.
You know, we just need a crisis of confidence in these institutions, and it's coming on more and more all the time.
You know, Iceland did kind of backpedal after about a year. They did come to an agreement with the International Monetary Fund, but they got a really good deal.
Yeah.
Because they initially stood up and said they were going to refuse to pay.
Wasn't that a referendum?
Well, the voters did a referendum, but then it was...
But at least the people were saying it. And I tell you what, man, I got a really cool song here.
Okay.
Whenever you're ready for a song.
Okay. Do we have any more news?
I just want to make one more comment on this, and that is I'm so glad Oakland's standing up, but their particular action would be a lot more effective if this kind of approach could spread to other
cities.
Yes,
indeed. Tom, you got another story?
For workers working outside in temperatures regularly topping off in the high 90s, keeping hydrated is the key to keeping yourself healthy. Dehydration can be dangerous if you let it go too far. The Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics lists the following as early signs of dehydration: thirst, headache, flushed skin, premature fatigue, increased body temperatures, faster breathing and pulse rate, increased perception of effort, and decreased exercise capacity. More advanced symptoms include dizziness and fainting, unusual weakness, and labored breathing. It is important to drink fluids before, during, and after any exercises, including work, even if you don't feel particularly thirsty. A general guideline is to have 16 ounces an hour before exercise or work, 4 to 8 ounces every 15 minutes during physical activity, and then another 16 ounces an hour after activities. Aside from keeping hydrated during activities, you should be drinking throughout the day to meet your body's requirements. In the past, 8 glasses of water per day was the standard recommendation, but we now know that that number is only arbitrary depending on the actual heat and the intensity of the work you are doing.
Okay.
Well, thank you for the toolbox topic.
The toolbox
next week
topic
is horseplay.
Horseplay.
I would describe that as a public service announcement.
Well, you know,
well, I mean, that's we have a, that's our safety meeting.
Yeah.
I mean, that would have been a good safety meeting on one of our jobs.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay. This last story: in Spanish coal miners agreed to, angered by huge cuts in government subsidies for the industry, have converged on Madrid for protest rallies after walking for nearly 3 weeks under a blazing sun from their pits. Two columns of miners met up in Madrid suburb on Tuesday evening and marched to the Puerta del Sol, the Spanish capital's most emblematic square, where young demonstrators opposed to austerity cuts prompted by the financial crisis in Spain and Europe camped out last year in defiance of a government ban. The miners, wearing hard hats with lights turned on, were joined by thousands of sympathizers. Some lit flares above highway overpasses and erected banners comparing the miners' plight to that of Spain's increasingly pressured working class, hit by higher taxes, new regulations making it cheaper to fire workers, and funding cuts for initiating cuts for education, national health care. One mile from Madrid, and about 40 made an almost equally long trek from the northeast Aragon region. A much larger rally of miners and supporters traveling to Madrid aboard hundreds of chartered buses is scheduled to arrive. Well, did arrive Wednesday. Among the miners' complaints is a 63% cut in subsidies to coal mining companies struggling to maintain a share of the Spanish energy market against gas-fired electrical plants and renewable energy sources, while fighting to hold their own against cheaper imported coal. Okay, Bill, you said you have a song for us, and then we're going to be hearing from Tom Thomas's poem. What's the song?
This is Money Talks by James Luther Dickinson and the North Mississippi All-Stars, and it just really hit me. And you can easily substitute Obama for Bush in his little monologue coming up.
Okay.
Ready? I'm with the auxiliary channel.
Yep, go ahead.
All righty, here we go.
Shall we pray? Our Father who art in Washington, George Bush is his name. He's taken me off Sensimilla, putting me back on Novocaine. It was the prettiest flower ever I smelt was the lily of the beach. And the worst whiskey I drunk today right here on old Beale Street. Because a hop of grass makes the hops, a honeybee makes the honey. The good Lord makes the pretty girls, and somebody else makes all the money. Still carrying on, money talks. Just like corn stalks. You notice human beings right here today that can still be bought. Cause money talks. Just as sure as you're born. God bless the child.
We're now at that portion of the program, the Illinois World Labor Hour Cultural Corner, with Tom Thomas's an older poem from his book's Cry for Justice. It's time for some philanthropy.
We need an emancipation proclaimed all across this land, that the rich start getting poorer so the poor may have cash in hand. Free medicines to everyone who desires to have good health. Equality is substantial when health does not depend on wealth. Let's let the wealthy heat our homes and cool us in the blazing heat. Make them give up enough dollars that families don't sleep in the streets. What say? They just can't afford it? Then how can they afford their wars, costing some trillions of dollars far beyond America's shores? Instead of teaching our children the fairy tales that we were taught, we should teach them liberty's dreams, those for which their forefathers fought. Teach them all to stand together and say it's time this world changed. The downtrodden must be rescued, and for them safe shelter arranged. The fat cats need to spread their cash amongst the hungry and the poor. If they can't share some of their wealth, they don't deserve it anymore. It's Time for Some Philanthropy was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois in 2009 and was brought to you live today, July 14th, 2012, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. If endless war and economic inequality don't suit your idea of a good time, please join AWARE, the anti-war and racism effort, and Occupy Champaign-Urbana on the streets today to protest against them. Today it's from 2 to 4 p.m., and it happens to be Bastille Day at the corner, and this gathering will be at the corner of Main and Neal Street in downtown Champaign. This is postponed from last week due to the terrible heat, and there's two anniversaries today that they acknowledge. One is Bastille Day, the 233rd anniversary of the French Revolution, and they're saying that some people, if they're welcome to, they can sing the song Marseille, or wear the squares of red cloth of this year's Quebec anti-austerity protest, or about no cuts like those from demonstrators happening now in Spain. And anyway, they also acknowledge that today is Woody Guthrie's 100th birthday, and they say that they're definitely going to have to sing either Union Made or Maybe This Land Is Your Land. So get out today and show your opposition to endless wars and economic inequality that it causes. That's today at the corner of Main and Neal, downtown Champaign, from 2 to 4 p.m.
Hey, you know what?
And don't forget that tonight is also the Folk and Roots concert in honor of Woody Guthrie, and it's going to be at Micah Malloy's in downtown Champaign. It will start about 8 o'clock, and there is a fee.
That's Molly's.
What did I say?
Malloy. You know, I tell people.
So it's Irish folk songs.
And I really, and also when you're there, please notice the beer garden with the stamped and dyed concrete. That looks really cool. I watched the crew do that years ago.
Okay. All right. Okay. We're going to be right back with a little bit of me talking about my recent trip to Cuba here. And in the meantime, I'm going to play a little Cuban music here that I actually I got a CD down in when I was in Havana from this band I watched at this restaurant bar I frequented, and actually got to talk with the band members. And their name of the band is Frase. And this song they're going to be doing is called Comandante Che Guevara. So stay tuned.
Un homenaje al invencible comandante Ernesto Che Guevara. A quererte,
che comandante,
desde la histórica altura,
che comandante,
donde el son de tu bravura,
che comandante,
le puso cerco a la muerte.
Aquí se queda la clara, la entrañable transparencia.
Dispara,
che comandante,
cuando todo Santa Clara,
che comandante,
se levanta para verte.
Aquí se queda la clara,
la clara,
la
Okay, that was Frase, a band from Havana, Cuba, singing Comandante Che Guevara. So, I had an opportunity in June to go to Cuba for a week. Some friends of mine, Gene Vanderport and Jermaine Light, actually talked me into this and kind of, you know, helped with some of the arrangements and stuff. And it was through a group called Global Justice, okay? Just to let everybody know, you just can't, even though there's flights leaving the United States from Miami and Tampa and New York City and San Francisco that fly directly to Havana, as an American citizen or a permanent resident alien here, you just can't hop on a plane and leave and go to Havana. You've got to get permission from the United States government, in particular the U.S. Treasury Department, okay? So what most people do is they find a tour group, and there's a lot of them out there now, that specialize in these trips to Cuba, and they've got like what's called an umbrella license that they have to pay money for every year, and there's all these restrictions upon that license. So basically that costs a person anywhere from $300 and up just for every week you're there, okay? And that's in addition to the airfare. So basically you got to pay for the privilege to go to Cuba, more or less. And then once you're there, you're expected to stay within the tour group you go with. In other words, you're supposed to stay with them doing all their scheduled and reported activities that they state that they're going to be doing there to the U.S. Treasury Department. And they also highly try to pressure you into staying in these overpriced hotels. So I went and I stayed in the hotel one night, and then the rest of the time I stayed in, I rented rooms from individual Cubans. They're called Casa Particulares. And I'll give you an example, the overpriced hotel I stayed in was $80 a night, which is a lot of money in Latin America or the Caribbean. Renting rooms from families like I did, I stayed in three different places when I was there. $20 for two nights I spent $20, the two of the places, and the third place I spent $25 a night, and got breakfast thrown in for that, which was, got to try some home-cooked Cuban food and got to actually, you know, talk to these people and stuff that, rent these rooms and everything. So basically that's kind of what I did. Now, when I went down there, so you also have to have a reason to go down there too. And the reason within this tour group was there was a conference at the University of Havana during the whole week, which was titled Socialist Renovation and Capitalist Crisis. And there was about 30 people from the United States. It just so happens that in the group I was in, there was two people from Lafayette, Indiana, two people from Bloomington, Indiana, and a professor from Loyola University in Chicago, and a guy from Lansing, Michigan. So we had a fair representation of the, you know, this area, actually, there. Everybody else was from both coasts, you know, basically New York City, Boston, San Francisco, Seattle areas and stuff. You know, it's real interesting. When I arrived there at the airport, got a cab, talked to the cab driver a little bit, and hardly anybody speaks English. I mean, very, very few people speak English. They might know a few words, maybe a few phrases, but with my all the Spanish I studied before I went, I'm glad I did. Found out that the taxi driver that picked me up at the airport used to be an engineer who worked for the government, and he actually makes between 5 and 10 times as much money driving a cab than working as an engineer for the government. But the first thing I really noticed driving the airport, what really hit me, I was in Cuba, was seeing all these billboards. Normally I've been to, other places I've been in Latin America, Caribbean, has been Jamaica a couple times, I've been to Mexico 3 times, and I've been to Brazil once. And unlike the usual billboards you see for Coca-Cola or cell phone ads or whatever, you see instead billboards, with pictures of Che Guevara and Camilo Sinfuegos, very few, very, very few of Fidel Castro. These billboards had their pictures and various, political slogans and stuff. So, when I saw those, that's when it really hit me. Oh, my gosh, I'm really in Cuba, because this is very unusual. And, of course, the other thing that's really odd there, is that 1 in 4 cars on the road are pre-1960 American cars, which are in incredible shape. I mean, it's incredible.
I know, man. You know, there's possibilities there for some business.
Well, I'll tell you what. You know what? Not on my trip, I didn't notice it, but our mutual friend Marty Conless, from used to be at the Labor Beat in Chicago, lives out in Sacramento now. He went on a trip in March, actually, with the Sacramento Community College, and he said there were a lot of wealthy people on that trip. And you know, he said that he kind of talked to some of them over the course of time, and it turned out that they're like vultures. I mean, they see an opportunity coming here. And one of their main things they were doing there was buying paintings. Because you can't...
That's interesting.
Well, you can't bring anything back from Cuba except... The only exception is you can bring things of quote-unquote communication. So you can bring back books, CDs, DVDs, and I guess posters, and I guess paintings fall into this
category. Well, I suppose you could bring back money, too, since money is speech in the United States.
You know, Bill, I never considered that.
If they had any money to bring back, but I
yeah, know. Yeah. So.
Touche, Bill, touche. Well, you know, talking about the potential for money in the old cars, the spanking new-looking old cars of Cuba, I'm just wondering, one of the topics of the conference that you went to was kind of what kinds of restructuring in the Cuban economy should occur in the future. What kind of ideas were being tossed around?
Well, the real popular one was worker-owned cooperatives, because what's really interesting, and I didn't find this out till I was already there, like a day and a half, is that all these, you know, restaurants and these even little hole-in-the-wall bars and everything is owned by the government. In other words, these restaurants and bars, I mean, they're like here. I mean, some are okay, some not so okay, and some are really good, you know. And it really was... different than what I had expected, because I always heard stories about, you know, Soviet-type restaurants, which I had images of these really run-down cafeteria-like places with really crappy food.
I'm having images of the movie Brazil.
Okay, all right.
And people who remember that by Terry Gilliam in the 80s.
Yeah, but that wasn't the case at all. I mean, it was just like being anywhere else, for that matter, you know, with privately owned bars and restaurants and stuff. But, yeah, the thing about worker-owned cooperatives is that was a real hot topic there. And actually,
really? I'm very happy to hear that.
Well,
because that's real communism.
know? Well, that's interesting, because currently, since there's been a lot of changes in Cuba in the last 10 years in particular. You know, after the fall of after the end of the Cold War, you know, Cuba no longer had the Soviet Union as a major trading partner, as well as also, you know, a certain amount of Soviet support as far as cheap or free items and stuff. So for 10 years from like roughly 1990 to 2000, I mean, they went through some really difficult economic times. And in fact, that's, if you remember right, there was a lot of Cubans in boats trying to get to Florida during the 90s. And that was the reason. It wasn't political, it was economic, you know.
Yeah, and really, I'm trying to imagine what it's like there, because there, I don't know, has there ever been much like industry, heavy industry? Is it now sort of a non-industrial, maybe even a completely new type of thing?
Well,
you know, post-industrial, with people in their cooperatives and organic farming and their advanced medical. Techniques that are based on organic, you know, type of stuff.
That's an interesting question, because frankly, I didn't notice hardly any industry there. I did find out at the conference that Cuba imports 70% of its food. It's interesting, when I went out in the countryside, it was about a 150-mile trip to this town I went to. I mean, along the way, you know, along the interstates, which aren't in too bad a shape compared to most countries I've been in Latin America, Caribbean, not as good a shape as ours here. But nevertheless, you know, we're driving along and I'm seeing, you know, occasional agricultural field. It's all flat land, I mean, with some mountains in the background. Looks a lot like central Illinois, except for the mountains. But what was interesting was that there were very few agricultural fields. Most of it was just idle land, you know, grass and shrub trees and that sort of thing. And we found out in the conference that Cuba's only using about 20% of its potential as far as agricultural land. And they're trying to get people, younger people, that are still in middle school and high school, interested in careers in agricultural sciences, and trying to get people to move out in the countryside and form cooperatives and actually start using more of this idle land. But the problem is people that grew up in the cities don't want to go out in the countryside. It's
darn.
You know?
Well, I hope that they do succeed in that. I understand, too, that they did have to switch to organic techniques
yes.
due to their inability to get fertilizer.
Yes.
And I would think, I really hope they can convince people to do that. I think people might find that their lives might be a little bit better.
Well, that's interesting because when I was out in this town I went to, it was a population of about 20,000 people 3 hours west of Havana, is that I immediately noticed, how much better the people lived there. Their houses were in really nice shape for the most part. There was abundance of fruit trees and vegetable gardens everywhere. Pigs and chickens running around. It was people, they almost seemed like they were middle class living in that town. Now, in Havana, what's interesting is, first of all, the downside is that their buildings are just falling apart. In horrible condition. Now, on the inside of the buildings, people have their own, apartments or whatever fixed up pretty nice. It's just the outside of the buildings are literally falling apart. And the infrastructure, the sidewalks and stuff, that's probably one of the biggest dangers of walking around Havana at night is not getting robbed, but falling in an open manhole sewer or tripping over busted up chunks of concrete. But what I'm getting to here, Bill, is what's fascinating is I noticed the first day I was there, or actually the second day I was there, when I was staying at the first Casa Particular, I was up on the sixth floor. I had a little balcony, and I could see all these rooftop gardens on all these roofs. And the first morning I woke up there, I got woke up at 4 a.m. by roosters crowing, and they were all over the place. First close, then in the distance, then a little closer. And this went on for 2 hours. So a lot of people have chickens in Havana, too. So. But I also found out that there's an emerging solar panel industry actually in Cuba, that both for domestic use and that they're starting to export to other Latin American countries.
Well, another industry that, of course, actually collapsed partly because many of the owners fled to other countries like Nicaragua was, of course, cigars. And,
I wouldn't say that industry collapsed.
There still is a bit of that going on.
There's a lot of it, yes. Other than tourism's the primary economic engine of Cuba, and followed by tobacco and cigars, and then followed by that sugar and rum. There's quite a. People that come there. Let's put it this way: everybody but United States citizens go there buy. Consume while they're there, as well as take home with them a lot of cigars. It's quite, quite active.
That's ever since my childhood. I remember that being sort of a meme or something, and so many TV shows and movies. The Cuban cigar. It was like they're getting some dope or something.
Well, I have to say, and I'm not someone who has ever smoked many cigars. But I did have a cigar in Nicaragua when I was there a few years ago that was essentially produced in a factory that was from a family that had fled from Cuba. And so they had essentially some of the same kind of tobacco, et cetera. And darn, that thing was really mild and very, very different than what you expect a cigar to be. It didn't have the harshness that cigars can have. It was extraordinary. It was almost sweet. It was like smoking sweet leaves.
Interesting. I didn't smoke a cigar there. I was going to try one, but I got sick. I got a little intestinal sickness, which is common when you go to a Latin American Caribbean country. And I did, towards the end of the trip, and I just didn't have, no pun intended, the stomach for it. But I want to mention here, one of the first, I went with an open mind there. I didn't know what to expect in Cuba. I've heard, a lot of stories over the years. But, the first thing that struck me when I went out about that evening, I was kind of hanging out in some restaurants and bars and stuff. It was a Sunday night, and I noticed all these people walking around. Young people, couples, families, young and old, very racially mixed. Very racially mixed up, so to speak, as far as people mingling with other people. But what was interesting is everyone's walking around, and a lot of people are openly drinking beer, walking down the street and stuff. And I saw they were all walking this one direction. I knew the seawall was down there a couple blocks away, the Malecón. So I eventually walked down there, and it was amazing. There were hundreds, if not thousands, of people just hanging out along the seawall, drinking, playing guitar, having a good time and stuff. And the first thing I thought of, of, man, if that would happen here in an informal gathering like that of people drinking alcohol in public, I mean, they'd have the riot squad out here if you didn't have special permits and restrictions and all sorts of things. And that's what kind of struck me. Not to mention the young people. A lot of the young people I saw had weird haircuts, tattoos, piercings. And so, you know, I'm thinking, you know, this doesn't really seem like an oppressive society. I'm not saying there isn't oppressive elements of the Cuban society. But that kind of struck me, first of all, is like, boy, this doesn't seem like the stories I've heard. And also when I encountered, I didn't see any police until the next day when I went over to the more touristy areas. And in the more touristy areas, they got a police officer about every other street corner. And unlike the police I've seen in other third world countries like Mexico, Jamaica, and Brazil, where you see there in those countries, the cops oftentimes driving around in pickup trucks with machine guns and shotguns and just glaring at people, just look like they're, you know, itching for a fight. I didn't see that with the Cuban police at all. I mean, they seem pretty laid back. I saw Cubans going, you know, talking to them all the time and laughing with them and stuff. And so, you know, those were two aspects. And also, on top of that, just I was there the whole week talking to various Cubans. You know, I expected to get spoon-fed propaganda at the conference. And frankly, I was even surprised there because there was a couple of Cuban presenters that were very critical of the government as far as what they're doing economically and politically, too, even talking about how the media in Cuba is a state media and not a public media. It needs to be a public media. But nevertheless, just talking to ordinary Cubans out and about, you know, bars, restaurants, wherever, I was really surprised, first of all, how much they knew about what's going on in the United States. And secondly, they didn't have any, they weren't timid at all telling, you know, me what they thought about the Cuban government, its policies. I mean, there was a common theme that as much as they admired Fidel Castro for the, you know, his leadership of the revolution, that they thought he should have stepped down as leader a long, long time ago.
Yeah, you sent us all some notes on your trip, which I found very interesting. And one of the most interesting aspects, I thought, was your ability to walk up to people and get a sense that they were speaking freely. I contrast this with recently there were reports in about the floods in Russia, mm-hmm. and reporters going into those towns and wanting to talk to the residents who clearly were very angry because there's some suggestion that they knew, the authorities knew about the potential for flooding in advance and didn't put out the word. And yet they were basically not willing to talk to reporters because they said we might end up dead.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
How interesting.
That's Putin's Russia.
Okay. Now, you know, one thing at the conference, one of the, you know, I said one of the most popular issues there was the thing about the cooperatives. You know, talking to some people too, like in this bar restaurant I frequent, I talked to this one waitress about it, and she said, oh, that'd be great. She said, because, you know, we would love to, you know, because we could make some more money because we see that the government's making a lot of money off this and we're on a set salary. But she then said, then she smiled at me and said, well, in that regard, as far as them turning over, you know, state-run businesses into worker-owned cooperatives, is talk, and action's action, and we'll see about that. So they, you know, she at least wasn't real confident that it was going to happen anytime soon. Kind of, you know, I guess kind of a healthy skepticism. But one of the biggest contentious issues of the conference was that some people in the Cuban delegation were talking about the government wants to actually start allowing Cubans to open their own private businesses and hire Cubans as workers. And that was very, very, very controversial because a lot of people said, well, this is going to begin to open the door for worker exploitation and stuff. So that, like I said, that was a very contentious issue.
I also was impressed that you indicated that it seemed like many Cubans really had a pretty good sense of what was going on in the United
mm-hmm.
States.
Yeah, they have. I mean, it's amazing. One in three Cubans I met had family here, not just in Miami. I mean, places like New Jersey and Las Vegas and Seattle and stuff. And so I imagine maybe part of that is from their relatives. But also when I was there, I,